Part 3. In this part, you will hear two segments from a radio program. After each segment, you will hear six questions about it. Before each segment begins, you will have time to review the questions. You will hear each segment twice. Then you will hear the questions once. Choose the correct answer A, B, or C. Look at the questions, then listen to the first segment. Now you will hear the first segment.
For years, people in the U.S. intentionally hunted gray wolves until they became extinct. Farmers had a lot to gain from a smaller wolf population, but the impact within the wolf's ecosystem was far from beneficial. But gray wolves are now making a dynamic comeback, Emma Tyler reports.
Gray wolves, also called timber wolves, are near the top of their food chain. This means that they weed out the weaker game, which allows the stronger game to survive and reproduce. When their numbers diminished, the ripple effect on fauna and flora was quickly evident. For example, the environment in Yellowstone National Park seriously suffered from overgrazing by elk, whose numbers were previously kept down by wolves. What's more, smaller game that feed on the scraps left behind by wolves sometimes reach the verge of starvation. However, populations are today on the increase, and ecologist Ryan Wilson is here to tell us more.
Emma, the wolves' fierce fangs and their fondness for livestock rendered them fearsome, hated creatures in children's stories and in people's minds. In Montana alone, 100,000 gray wolves were killed between 1883 and 1942. Even in the 1970s, federal wildlife management authorities poisoned wolves living in the wild. Since then, conservationist protests that balance in nature should be restored became louder. Although the livestock industry tried to muffle these voices, the U.S. government soon ruled in favor of nature. The first move was relocating 29 wolves from Alberta, Canada to Yellowstone National Park in 1995. The following year, 37 more wolves were transferred to the park from central Idaho.
Preserving and regrowing the dwindling populations hasn't been an easy ride, though, as wolves, unlike the prolific rabbit, do not reproduce so easily. Many times, only the alpha female in the pack will produce offspring. However, wolves manage to boom at a shocking speed of 30% per year, a faster rate than almost any other endangered species. But this didn't come without a price. In 15 years, wolves were reported to have killed over 850 head of livestock. How has the U.S. government responded to this threat, Ryan?
This mixed bag of effects has made the government introduce a scheme whereby wolves are simultaneously protected as an endangered species and managed when they get too close to homes or farms. Farmers are allowed to gun down wolves only if their cattle are attacked. In many of the packs, at least one wolf has been outfitted with a special collar that allows wildlife officials to keep track of the pack if the animals are causing trouble. Bottom line, one thing's for certain. Since their reintroduction, wolves have turned the tables, which made the federal government remove them from the endangered species list in March 2008.
Now you will hear the segment again.
For years, people in the U.S. intentionally hunted gray wolves until they became extinct. Farmers had a lot to gain from a smaller wolf population, but the impact within the wolf's ecosystem was far from beneficial. But gray wolves are now making a dynamic comeback, Emma Tyler reports.
Gray wolves, also called timber wolves, are near the top of their food chain. This means that they weed out the weaker game, which allows the stronger game to survive and reproduce. When their numbers diminished, the ripple effect on fauna and flora was quickly evident. For example, the environment in Yellowstone National Park seriously suffered from overgrazing by elk, whose numbers were previously kept down by wolves. What's more, smaller game that feed on the scraps left behind by wolves sometimes reached the verge of starvation. However, populations are today on the increase, and ecologist Ryan Wilson is here to tell us more.
Emma, the wolf's fierce fangs and their fondness for livestock rendered them fearsome, hated creatures in children's stories and in people's minds. In Montana alone, 100,000 gray wolves were killed between 1883 and 1942. Even in the 1970s, federal wildlife management authorities poisoned wolves living in the wild. Since then, conservationist protests that balance in nature should be restored became louder. Although the livestock industry tried to muffle these voices, the U.S. government soon ruled in favor of nature. The first move was relocating 29 wolves from Alberta, Canada to Yellowstone National Park in 1995. The following year, 37 more wolves were transferred to the park from central Idaho.
Preserving and regrowing the dwindling populations hasn't been an easy ride, though, as wolves, unlike the prolific rabbit, do not reproduce so easily. Many times, only the alpha female in the pack will produce offspring. However, wolves manage to boom at a shocking speed of 30% per year, a faster rate than almost any other endangered species. But this didn't come without a price. In 15 years, wolves were reported to have killed over 850 head of livestock. How has the U.S. government responded to this threat, Ryan?
This mixed bag of effects has made the government introduce a scheme whereby wolves are simultaneously protected as an endangered species and managed when they get too close to homes or farms. Farmers are allowed to gun down wolves only if their cattle are attacked. In many of the packs, at least one wolf has been outfitted with a special collar that allows wildlife officials to keep track of the pack if the animals are causing trouble. Bottom line, one thing's for certain. Since their reintroduction, wolves have turned the tables, which made the federal government remove them from the endangered species list in March 2008.
Number 39. What is the report mainly about? Number 40. How did wolf hunting affect elk in Yellowstone National Park? Number 41. Who were in favor of wolf extermination? Number 42. What is surprising about the wolves' comeback? Number 43. What is the controversy surrounding wolf reintroduction? Number 44. What did the speaker mean by the phrase, "have turned the tables"? Look at the questions, then listen to the second segment. Now you will hear the second segment.
Pack your things, board your Star Cruiser, and off you go. It's not a dialogue from a science fiction movie. It's quite a realistic life scenario. Experts say that, albeit not in great big leaps, we will eventually be able to colonize space. Rebecca Roberts reports.
Modern man has plundered our planet to such an extent that the Earth will soon no longer be able to sustain its growing population. So, if mankind is to survive, the answer is in the final frontier. Aerospace engineer John Murphy can tell us more.
Rebecca, after putting the moon within easy reach, establishing a lunar outpost seemed the next logical step. The moon offers several advantages. It's in our backyard, so crews could get back and forth in just a few days, and there would be no delays in communications between colonists and Earth-based mission commanders. But the lack of atmosphere generates huge temperature extremes, and the moon's surface is battered by micrometeorites and cosmic rays, which means that colonists would have to build their habitats under the soil or at the base of a lava tube. And then food and water is another issue. Although it is believed that water is buried in the soil, facilities will need to be built to extract it. And growing plants in the long lunar nights with no insects for pollination could prove to be quite a challenge.
And that's why some scientists say we should skip the moon and head straight for Mars. The blueprint includes sending an unmanned Earth Return Vehicle, or ERV, to Mars. How will that work, John?
A nuclear reactor aboard the ERV will be used to power a chemical processing unit capable of manufacturing propellant using compounds found in the Martian atmosphere. 2 years later, another unmanned ERV will launch and head for a second landing site. At the same time, a manned spacecraft will touch down near the first ERV. After an 18-month exploration stay, the crew will return to Earth using fuel manufactured on-site. On departure of the first crew, another team will arrive, and the process will repeat itself until a string of bases is established.
But long-term settlement on Mars isn't child's play. Something like this would necessitate transforming the planet so that life on it can simulate Earth-like conditions. From what I know, this process is known as terraforming. What exactly does it involve, John?
Terraforming involves building soil processing units that pump super greenhouse gases into the Martian atmosphere. These gases would absorb solar energy and warm the planet, prompting the release of carbon dioxide from the soil and polar ice caps. Atmospheric pressure would increase in response to carbon dioxide building up in the atmosphere. Additional warming would occur, and oceans would form. Eventually, colonists would be able to survive without spacesuits, although they would still need to wear oxygen tanks.
Until that is achieved, let's just hope that we manage to curb the exploitation and depletion of our planet's natural resources and take the Earth off this path of destruction before it's too late.
Now you will hear the segment again.
Pack your things, board your Star Cruiser, and off you go. It's not a dialogue from a science fiction movie. It's quite a realistic life scenario. Experts say that, albeit not in great big leaps, we will eventually be able to colonize space. Rebecca Roberts reports.
Modern man has plundered our planet to such an extent that the Earth will soon no longer be able to sustain its growing population. So, if mankind is to survive, the answer is in the final frontier. Aerospace engineer John Murphy can tell us more.
Rebecca, after putting the moon within easy reach, establishing a lunar outpost seemed the next logical step. The moon offers several advantages. It's in our backyard, so crews could get back and forth in just a few days, and there would be no delays in communications between colonists and Earth-based mission commanders. But the lack of atmosphere generates huge temperature extremes, and the moon's surface is battered by micrometeorites and cosmic rays, which means that colonists would have to build their habitats under the soil or at the base of a lava tube. And then food and water is another issue. Although it is believed that water is buried in the soil, facilities will need to be built to extract it. And growing plants in the long lunar nights with no insects for pollination could prove to be quite a challenge.
And that's why some scientists say we should skip the moon and head straight for Mars. The blueprint includes sending an unmanned Earth Return Vehicle, or ERV, to Mars. How will that work, John?
A nuclear reactor aboard the ERV will be used to power a chemical processing unit capable of manufacturing propellant using compounds found in the Martian atmosphere. 2 years later, another unmanned ERV will launch and head for a second landing site. At the same time, a manned spacecraft will touch down near the first ERV. After an 18-month exploration stay, the crew will return to Earth using fuel manufactured on-site. On departure of the first crew, another team will arrive, and the process will repeat itself until a string of bases is established.
But long-term settlement on Mars isn't child's play. Something like this would necessitate transforming the planet so that life on it can simulate Earth-like conditions. From what I know, this process is known as terraforming. What exactly does it involve, John?
Terraforming involves building soil processing units that pump super greenhouse gases into the Martian atmosphere. These gases would absorb solar energy and warm the planet, prompting the release of carbon dioxide from the soil and polar ice caps. Atmospheric pressure would increase in response to carbon dioxide building up in the atmosphere. Additional warming would occur, and oceans would form. Eventually, colonists would be able to survive without spacesuits, although they would still need to wear oxygen tanks.
Until that is achieved, let's just hope that we manage to curb the exploitation and depletion of our planet's natural resources and take the Earth off this path of destruction before it's too late.
Number 45. What is the report mainly about? Number 46. What does the phrase "it's in our backyard" suggest about the moon? Number 47. Why would lunar colonists have to live underground? Number 48. What will the nuclear reactor aboard the ERV do? Number 49. What is terraforming? Number 50. What does the expert say about carbon dioxide in the Martian atmosphere? End of the listening test.